Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station for the arts.
That's right.
I'm Nicholas Miller, here as ever with
Steve Cato. Hi, it's me. I'm Steve Cato, and welcome back to The Talking Show. We took a little break.
It's true, yeah. There was some wrenches tossed into the well-oiled machine.
Yeah. You know, and you don't do a show for, I don't know what, 10 years, 12 years?
Without the occasional wrench.
Yeah. You know, and these weren't bad wrenches, really. Like, it wasn't like a, like you were in a movie.
I was in a, well, I was going to say a minor motion picture, but I guess the jury's still out on that one. It could be.
You just got to wait.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. How, like, and since considering that you were just, filmed for it, when is it actually scheduled to complete itself?
Well, they shot it on 16 millimeter film, so I learned that they don't have what they call dailies.
No,
they have what they call weeklies, because they ship it out to the processor. I'm sure a bigger production they'd process it a lot faster.
So
I was there. I think they'd already done a week of shooting. It's a 3-week shoot, and the day after I left, they were getting their first chunk of weeklies, and I guess they'd find out whether they'd have any film at all or not, like whether the thing was in focus, or there was some fear of fogging because of the weather, that like the film gets foggy in that Central Coast, you know, foggy weather, I guess.
Yeah, there's a moisture a in places it shouldn't be kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, so the film loader was taping everything. The camera looked like some kind of Frankenstein of blue tape.
Wild.
There wasn't any room to ask any questions. I just gleaned what I could.
Interesting. But yeah, so but I guess what I mean is like they would have like a production schedule, and then they would have a post-production schedule, and then they would be like, movie is done.
Okay, so with, you know, extrapolating the timeline here. Yeah. So if they're shooting for 3 weeks and they're getting each week of footage a week after it's been shot, and then they'll probably have to go scan that to have an editable version.
I imagine when they get the weeklies, the lab just sends them scans.
Okay, cool. So then I guess they'd have all the digital files probably end of next month. And then God knows how long it'll take to edit.
Right. Like I guess like productions usually have a schedule, but that just wasn't shared with you to the effect of the post-production or whatever. Like, because
I think it was largely funded by the filmmaker himself and a Kickstarter campaign. And I don't think that the Kickstarter, it's not like having a board of directors or something, you know?
Right.
Or like having an executive, like a Hollywood producer, where they're like, you know, we want this thing to come out because our interest
is
the best.
But you can only afford so much of X, Y, and Z professional time too, or whatever, right? Like you have like this much time with an editor or something. So
true. So, I mean, who knows? Maybe it'll come out this year.
Wow.
I think that a filmmaker like Rodolfo probably wants to hit those circuits, like the
festivals and such.
And I'm saying that like I know what those are, but I don't.
Yeah, and there's deadline, and like filmmakers are really, I don't know about them either, but filmmakers are very keenly aware of like the different deadlines for everything.
It's true. Yeah.
You know, they know when this film has to be ready to submit it to, you know, Sundance or whatever.
Well, and I think there's also kind of a knock-on thing, right? Like, it's like if you get into Telluride, then you often get into Sundance or whatever, so you got to make the Telluride deadline so that to hope
a short film before, and then someone was like, we'll fast-track you into Sundance if you can make the deadline.
Exactly.
Which motivates you to, like, make them. So I guess that was another part of my question, but the answer is you don't know.
Don't know.
I'm sure Rodolfo's got ideas, but...
Yeah. Probably very. He's got it all worked out, I'm sure.
Yeah. That's cool. And it sounds like you had fun. I have to say that being in movies always just seemed like a lot of work to me. But also, like, I wasn't really talent in the same way. I was always
semi-technical.
I was a cop.
Yeah.
I guess in some kinds of filmmaking, everyone's just like something for the light to shine off of. and so you're not really talent in that case either. You're more of like everything sets, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I was there for the light to bounce off of and to vocalize. I vocalized for a few pages worth.
My actual face isn't in the movie I'm in.
Oh.
You just see sort of, I'm out of focus.
Yeah.
And I'm saying stuff, mm-hmm. and then you sort of see parts of me.
Right.
Like you see like my hands and chest and stuff. Yeah. And
I felt pretty good approaching the location. Like yeah. I practiced my lines with Ella, and then I practiced the whole drive up, you know, and I was like, oh, I don't have the kind of mind where I can memorize verbatim.
Yeah, right.
So there was a bit where it was like, when I'm hiking, I mark the territory by like, you know, orange string for this terrain, yellow string for this. And I was like, Rodolfo, I'm going to get the colors mixed up. Like, is that going to matter?
Yeah.
Like, is there a crucial scene at the end where they find an orange string or something? And he's like, no, just cut that part. It doesn't matter. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, that's easy. But that I was just trying to explain to him.
That is really funny. Yeah. they change scripts a lot too. Yeah.
I just trying to explain to him like how I would do it. And he was fine with that. But the things that caught me off guard were like, we shot out of order.
Right.
Which, you know,
it's common.
It's common. But the way I realized I had to wrap my head around that because I was like, oh, where am I emotionally at this point? Like there's like a kind of an altercation between my girlfriend in the film and the male lead in the film. And that had already happened
in the shot you filmed first.
Yeah. Whereas it hadn't, you know, and so I was, I got a little confused. I mean, I did the whole thing pretty flat, like a novice anyway. So it doesn't matter. The other thing that was confusing, and I should have thought about this, is there's like a picnic scene where we're sitting across from the two main actors and talking to them, but of course they're like 15 feet away, sitting next to the camera, you know, because of the way lenses work.
Yeah.
So I'm like having an intimate conversation with somebody who theoretically, like, you know, it's supposed to be 3 feet away, but they're like across the room.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, this is a little awkward. It's not, I don't really like this.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about this a lot, I think, at least in earlier moments, because, you know, this is a talking radio show.
Yeah.
And
sight lines don't matter.
And exactly. Well, but then the other part is that, like, I think one of the things that we've discussed in the past is like sort of differentiating like a more free flowing kind of like talking and performance kind of thing that's not theater.
That's
true. For example, and this line between theater and like, and broadly speaking, I you know, not to sound doctrinaire, but like I think we're like generally less into theater than other stuff. Like we don't go to the theater very much. Like theater people feel like an alien species when I meet them. Some of them are very nice, but you know, they just don't feel like the people I know. You know, they feel like another kind of entity. They feel like they come from another world, and you know, we were talking before we started recording about how Succession, you were saying Succession just feels like bad Shakespeare. And I was saying that like watching a lot of British detective stories, detective TV, that all the actors, when you look up, you know, what else has this person been in? And they're like, all of them are in Shakespeare all the time.
Yeah.
And you're sort of like, well, that can't be good Shakespeare either. Like it's Hamlet. Like it's like the tip top shit, but you're just sort of like, oh, so you play a detective on TV, but you're like Hamlet this summer in, I don't know, Wales or something, the Royal Welsh Theatre or something like that's production
Essex
of Hamlet.
On Trueborough or something.
Yeah, Up the Shrew on Stoke or whatever. who have a famous
something
Shakespeare festival. Yeah, exactly. You know, like, and so like, but I was thinking about it when you were talking about how weird it feels to like try and have a conversation with someone. And like, I've seen like, what I would say would be like one really good production of The Tempest, for example, where I was like, you know, like the final speech at the end where Prospero sort of like, you know, retires basically and like, and the play ends and, you know, I was like, it was quite moving, you know, and it is like, you know, you can read it and you're like, well, I bet that would be quite moving, but it's sort of like, it's a good, seeing something like that is a good argument for what theater can do. Cause it does like, tug at the heartstrings, it pulls you along, you go to this other place.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that I was remembering that feeling and just like this guy, when you're like, it's awkward talking to someone really far away, like they're close to you. It's like this guy does this production every day. First of all, he like wakes up and does a job. Like he 9-to-5s this. Right? Like he wakes up, brushes his teeth, eats his coffee, goes in, gets made up, and does like the matinee of The Tempest for like a busload of Canadian high school students. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's like, and like old people and stuff. And you're just sort of like, wow, you know, but just like to like sell it. You just got to sell, you got to believe in it enough that you like just sell it into the void, you know, into some weird theater. You're just sort of like, yeah, this is my interior state. I'm sharing my insides with you right now. All, you know, so I think it's like, that is what is so weird about acting.
Yeah.
Right. Is that like to an actor, and you were like, you were saying earlier, you were in this production with another actor, with people who are professionals.
There are four people in the scene, and all three of them at varying levels of success have,
but they do the job.
Yeah.
And
they identify as actors and they've done this before and they, yeah.
And I bet none of them found it like that weird.
No, I think I was the only one who was a little bit flummoxed by the great distance in which I had to talk intimately with this young Romanian woman.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, right? Because it's like, that's not what we're used to. It's like there's a sort of component of reality that separates the kind of performance work that like I think I do.
Yeah.
From what would properly be called theater, you know?
Right.
It's interesting. It's just one of those weird things where it's like you realize there's a whole other world out there. You know, you're like, wow.
Yeah, because these people were, Sky Raul, who is the male lead on the film, he was like flying to Spain the last day.
Jesus Christ.
My gosh. All these late night car horns going off.
Good luck getting out of the parking lot. Everyone who knows the Kaechang parking lot is locked. So let's see if this guy charges the gate later if we hear that.
Oh, dear. But anywho, Raul was flying to Spain to be in a TV show the day. And he's just like best case scenario every day the rest of the year. He's like traveling to do this kind of talking.
Yeah.
or actually doing it, you know.
Wild.
Yeah.
It's interesting, too, because it's like, you know, like, well, I'm going to talk a little bit about myself. I opened an art exhibit at a space that Nicholas and a friend of the show, Jeffrey Stuker, control, called Solds, opened a couple weeks ago. And that's one of the reasons why I wasn't around to do the talking show. I was busy getting the show up and running and then entertaining various... I've been very busy as well. I had a big bunch of work deadlines and stuff as well. And next Thursday.
Can we talk about that on here?
I'm going to do a drum machine. I'm going to do a music concert.
Oh, God. Steve's out of the closet.
I'm doing a solo drum machine performance. But I was like looking at my little drum machine bits today and I was like, I need to put this stuff in a bag. I need like a little, because I have like, I have like, I'm very proud of my ability to bag things up. Like,
he's a good bagger, folks.
Right here I have my like portable recording bag. It's in a little porta brace thing.
It
is from the movies. Like, it is like a bag that a movie sound guy would put a Nagra tape machine in, kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. The guy who lavalier mic'd me had that bag.
Or a bag like it, yeah.
Very similar.
Yeah. And so it's that kind of thing. You know, it's like, it's no wonder it works well for portable recording. It was designed to work well for that. But, you know, I have these great little kits. I was like, oh, time to put this drum machine stuff in a bag. So it's like, looks fun, so it's fun to carry, and it's like easy to put stuff away and get stuff, because that's what a good packing situation brings to you. You know, you get like you have a spot for the cables, you have a spot for the stuff, so that way when you're putting things away, everything goes back in a specific spot and nothing's in the way of anything else, and
you don't forget things that way.
And you don't forget things because you check the pocket, you know,
you're like pocket C is empty.
Oh, that cable still plugged into the wall or something like
those
that.
Those banana plugs.
Yeah, precisely.
They're hard to find.
And so I was just looking for a different bag. But if you're an actor, what, you just print out the script and get on the airplane to Spain? Like, you don't have to put your drum machine in a cute little bag.
You have to memorize things. You have to carry that baggage, which is hard for some people.
Well, where all this is going is we're putting stuff in specific places, either in one's noggin...
Yeah.
Or in a specified location.
Yeah.
and coming to conclusions about where things should go.
Yeah, I mean, what do they call that when you shove a bunch of stuff, you pull it out of the mind and you commit it to a medium and you shove it in a place for safekeeping?
Well, it could be called a records depot. It could be called a hall of records. It could be called an archive, a library, things like that.
Well, that's a pretty clean segue into our guest tonight. Well, tonight we found a very rare piece.
That's right.
Of radio history that we would like to share to you with very little introduction. Here we have a rare piece of radio history.
Now on Radio 4, Archive on 4, Matthew Sweet tries his best to evade posterity and for one night only to live in the moment.
Right. Well, the green light is on. We are live on BBC Radio 4. Archive on 4, live. That's never happened before. This is usually a programme about the past. It's a programme that offers you the presenter as truffle pig, snout deep in the loam of recorded history. But not tonight. Tonight's programme is all new. This is an Archive on 4 that asks, do we need this? And do we really need to keep that? Or that? Isn't it best sometimes not to burden the future with stuff? How many photos, for instance, did you take this week? Have you looked at them all? Don't you feel a pang of nostalgia for the time before we felt compelled to document our lunches? Isn't modern life getting a bit too archival? Now, I love an archive, me. Manuscripts, letters, index cards, printed ephemera. I love film archives and the thrill of popping a reel of 35mm out of its tin. Somewhere at home, I have a chewy bar, deliquescent with hydrogenated palm oil, that I've kept since 1982 because I like the picture on the wrapper. I've got a little cardboard box containing my daughter's correspondence with the fairies and years of little teeth bought with fairy pound coins. I know that the past is like a great ocean and the present is this tiny layer like the meniscus on the water. But tonight, you and me are going to forget the past and live in the moment. Tonight, we have to be here so we can say to anyone who wasn't, you had to be there. I want this programme to escape the archive. I have 5 pre-recorded elements to play out to you tonight, and at the end of the hour, I'm going to destroy them. So let me play out the first bit. It's me on a train in Sussex a couple of weeks ago.
We are now approaching Horsham. Please mind the gap between the platform and the train.
It's Horsham. It's the end of the line. The more I think about this, the more eccentric it seems.
A man called Brian Rust, who was the 50s British jazz expert on everything recorded from, let's say, 1922 up to maybe the early 30s. And there was a lot of records. So he had an enormous record collection, but his archives of details of who was on each record and what the matrix number and so on. And the joke about Brian Rust was at a certain point, they lived in a small flat, he and his wife and family, and his wife said, look, something has to go, either the archive or the record collection. He got rid of the record collection because the archive was to him more interesting.
I have in my hand a pair of keys, the keys to a fragment of my past lodged in Horsham. This is a crate that 11 years ago I loaded some things into it that I wanted to keep but had no space for. And this is where it's lived ever since. I'm trying to remember which way to go now. I might have to look at a map. I think it's down here.
There's a great short story by Borges called On Exactitude in Science, which is all about a map maker in the 17th century who started off making a map of the empire, which was the size of an entire province, and a map of the province that was the size of the entire empire. And then they decided that wasn't detailed enough. So let's have a map that's exactly the same size as the country that it's mapping. And what he was saying was, unless you select, unless you classify, unless you have a power that goes into the archive and decides what is useful information, basically you collect everything.
That's Christopher Frayling, Professor Sir Christopher Frayling, a man who loves celluloid and old bits of paper, a man after my own heart.
I must say none of this is really ringing a bell, but the sign pointed this way.
Around the time I snapped shut the padlock on my own personal archive, I had a chat with the filmmaker Mike Figgis. Not one of those normal chats, but one of those that get recorded and broadcast and then filed away somewhere for posterity. On any other edition of Archive on 4, we'd play you an extract from that. We'd hear me, and we'd hear Mike, a decade younger, discussing his plans to, well, to destroy the rushes of his films. You would have heard me using the word eutrophication, because I remembered it from my biology A-level. If you never did A-level biology, then this is what happens when fertiliser seeps into rivers and lakes and streams and turns them into a thick soup of algae. That's what Mike was trying to avoid, the soup. And he was going to take that soup and pour it in the bin.
I was trying to resist the tendency just to sort of fill bookshelves and not part with, as Spock would say, you know, the contents of the potty. I think what we were talking about were things like hundreds of tapes of everything shot on a film rather than the finished film. And I don't recall having any regrets about anything I've thrown away, but I did pretty much throw away an entire skip worth of what we call dailies or rushes tapes.
What do you remember about the act of throwing it away?
Liberation, complete liberation. And the same with bookcases. I always loved the Anthony Paul novel called Books Do Furnish a Room, thinking that's true and therefore one should act against. So rather than building more shelves, I kind of go, I've got enough shelves, and every couple of years I take them to a charity shop or I give them to people, making very clear decisions about I will never read this book again, therefore I don't need it to decorate the room. And I don't think I'll ever achieve this, to die in a room with one painting on the wall and nothing else, having given everything up, given that you're not run over by a bus or struck down by something, but in a natural cycle of life, you should end up in a more or less a beautifully empty room.
In this empty room in the future, though, in the room in which you die, which has a beautiful painting mm-hmm. on the wall, the one that you have chosen to spend your mm-hmm. last hours with, where is your work? Is that safe beyond the room somewhere?
I don't know. I mean, I'm dealing with it now because I'm at an age, you know, I'm in my late 60s now, where I seriously think about this issue of storage.
It's a storage place. I'm just looking for its address here. It's somewhere very nearby here.
I think.
Down there.
I mean, we're now in my studio, and despite my attempts to throw away, it's full of stuff.
Box files, mm-hmm. Document boxes, globes, shoes, rolls of fabric.
Mm-hmm. Space is very important. In order to think, you need space. The core of the conversation we had a decade ago was the idea that if there is too much stuff, I said too much culture, the ability to think clearly diminishes very, very quickly.
Bags and things in here?
Please, thanks, cheers.
I don't know if you have a paper-free office. I certainly don't. And, you know, occasionally you have to have a clear-out. You try and hold on to the important things, but no doubt in doing that, maybe there's a document stuck to the document you wanted to throw away, and then about a year later, where the hell is that document?
Just stand on the mat there, Frank. That's probably going to annoy it too, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Change of scene now. The Parliamentary Archive. Well, to be frank, we couldn't get in. It's being redecorated. So I can't give you the sound of me loitering in there, inhaling the goaty smell of legislative vellum. But I did meet the outgoing Parliamentary Archivist in a building over the road from the House of Commons. So this is me going through security.
All right, yeah, sorry, just bung him there. Thanks, OK? No worries. I just need to put my tag on and then rescuing my bag from the machine, and then we'll be through the door to see Caroline Shenton.
Caroline, let's get straight who you are and what you are.
I'm former director of the Parliamentary Archives, and I've been an archivist for nearly 25 years. The point about archives is that without them, we would all just be tiny little isolated rowing boats bobbing on this great sea of time. We wouldn't know who we were. We wouldn't have anything to anchor us in our communities or our societies and so on. But the other thing about archives, the physical thrill of opening up a file box and finding a bundle of records, the smell that comes off from the parchment, the tangible effect of opening up the canvas ribbons and so on, hearing the crackle of the paper as you open up an indenture from the 18th century, that's a fantastic sensual experience.
Do you have a powerful sense of responsibility?
Absolutely. I think it's exciting when you come across a piece of current information, you think, well, in future that's going to be of great interest to people.
Who do you imagine looking at it?
Oh, anybody.
Philip Larkin had this imagined figure of an academic who was working on his papers, who he naturally didn't like, who called him Jake Bolakowski, an American academic who was doing a thesis. I just wondered if there are figures like that in your head too.
No, there are no figures like that in my head at all. But of course, the interesting thing about Larkin was that he wasn't just a poet, he was a librarian.
Yeah. And Caroline, what did he ask to be done with his papers?
Oh, well, they are at the Hull History Centre.
But do you know what he asked them?
No.
For them to be done? He asked for them to be burned.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
But they weren't burned.
I think if you want to guarantee that your secrets are taken with you to the grave, it's best to burn things before you die rather than leave it to someone else.
Caroline Shenton, ending part one of this programme, which will never be on the iPlayer and will never be repeated and may never be heard again by anyone. Aids the concentration, doesn't it? If you know that you can't listen again, you have to pay attention. You can't just rewind if you find that your mind has wandered. You've missed it. That's it. Gone. And how rare that seems to be these days. It's affected more than just our viewing and listening habits. Now we go to places and maybe we don't look so hard because we can take a photo or a video clip and absorb it all later. Or not bother, but be faintly reassured by its presence on a hard drive or a phone or a data cloud that will still be there when we're dead. There are some people, though, who can do this with a reasonable sense that even if they can't be fagged to go through all this stuff, somebody else might. Highly regarded writers, for instance, the sort whose archives get bought up by libraries for the benefit of future scholars, like the novelist and screenwriter Hanif Qureshi, author of The Buddha of Suburbia and Intimacy. The British Library has just acquired his papery bits and pieces, drafts of his books, old letters, and his personal diaries. Imagine that, your teenage diary saved for posterity. The lead curator at the British Library is Joanna Knowledge, and she begins our next pre-recorded section.
The London Journal of Hanif Qureshi, aged 15. Thoughts of Life, January 1970. And there's a quotation, "Just wait and see, there will be none greater than me."
I mean, I wouldn't go into my desk now and get my diary out and show it to you and say, have a gander at that. But on the other hand, I think you should be open and free with these things. And in a way, as soon as you become an artist, you decide to go public.
And the first entry is the 29th of January 1970. Perhaps a great failing in life is due to wasting time. Instead of spending a few minutes here and there on useless things, it would be better to spend all one's spare time engrossed in one morally profitable aim.
I've got hundreds of notebooks, photographs, journals, diaries, and some of it, of course, is very personal about my private life, but there is also some interesting stuff in there about writers I've met and known, politicians I've met and known, directors I've worked with, and I would hope that some of it is concerned with race. My father was born under the British Empire and came from India to Britain after partition, so I grew up in this unique period, I guess, post-empire and through the beginning of multiculturalism.
This is a typescript draft of My Beautiful Laundrette, and it's annotated.
It's not really for me to say what people will make of it, but I handed it over, and it's there for scholars to look at.
Cataloguing is so behind in English county record offices. I think my local one has a 20-year backlog of material that hasn't even been looked at, let alone catalogued.
Right. Now, I have a note here that says this is the social historian Carolyn Steedman. Like most historians, she knows how to negotiate an archive, its paper slips, its ribbons and box files. And it's possible, of course, to make this a subject of study in itself, to catalogue the experience of what happens in archives.
You have a series of questions about some kind of story you want to tell about the past. And you're compelled to get on with it, to fill in gaps, to rectify things that other historians have said or that they haven't said. The documents are your evidence, or the closest you're going to get to some kind of truth. You're not deluded enough to think that you're ever going to find the truth. There isn't a truth, because the past was then and this is now.
I think it's a to-do list, hitch a lift, get a job washing up, look for digs and get them. Oh, maybe this is some kind of plot. To be honest, it's not.
Obviously, I couldn't sit down with a pencil and go through the whole stuff, so I just shut my eyes and handed it over and just hope that people can't read your writing.
31st of March, 1970. I don't want to go to school. I don't want to dig shit. I want to go... Ah, screams agony. Right. I've got to escape from everything and be free. I'm not free.
Most archives have gatekeepers. Most archives, the researcher cannot just walk down those stairs and start turning all those handles on the rolling shelving. They are environments that are at one remove from us, mainly.
The image in one's mind is the Thatcher reading room in Citizen Kane. Do you remember that huge, cavernous room where a rather forbidding lady with white gloves stands there? Come this way, you're only allowed to look at the ones you asked for in advance. I had to study in Paris in the archives of state when I was studying Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And Rousseau's manuscripts are next door to all these secret documents about Algeria and things. It's a government archive. So while I studied Rousseau, a gendarme with a machine gun was sitting at the end of the table watching my every movement.
It does say something, that, doesn't it, about the power of what resides there, that there is something potentially explosive about the archive.
Yes. Well, if you remember The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco, the function of the librarians is to keep people out.
What's your sense of how thoughts have changed about what it's necessary to preserve in the archive? Have the ideas or the conversation shifted?
Yes, the conversation shifted across all archive activity across the world, and indeed across all information professions, because of the arrival of digital information.
At the beginning of the 20th century, the concept of literacy meant that you could read, because frankly, writing was something that very few people did. If you were a high school...
Consulting the textual remains of the past used to require a pilgrimage. Now the mountain comes to you. 20 years ago, I wanted to read some local press reports on something that happened at Niagara Falls in the 1860s. I had to go to Niagara Falls. Now I just put some search terms into one of the online newspaper archives, and they're there. The 1860s are just a few clicks away. The whole process of historical research has been transformed, and with it, surely, the relationship between the past and the present, as both are now equally accessible. Alex Krotowski knows about stuff like this. She's the presenter of Radio 4's The Digital Human, and she says it's a new kind of literacy.
Fast forward to where we are now, and the concept of literacy isn't just about touch typing as quickly as possible with as many emojis as possible, but it's about incorporating and synthesizing concepts and content that does come from 1867, that came from 1,867 seconds ago, and incorporating the two and creating something that itself is a story, that itself has a narrative, and itself has a new idea. And so our concept of past and present now is very mashed up because we have access to literally everything at our fingertips. The genius and the literacy is when we can actually synthesize that into something new, useful, and possibly beautiful.
The challenge with digital is that it's not possible to select in the same way as we have in the past with paper, because simply there's too much stuff.
Imagine if somebody said to you that every text you'd ever sent, every photograph you'd ever taken, every time you go on the internet, everything is lodged somewhere. And after a time, you get a sense that this is a sort of madness. There's just more and more meaningless information. And one of the horrors of the digital age is that we can't get rid of anything. It would be as though we lived in a world in which nobody ever died. Now Elvis never dies. You know, not only is Elvis not dead, I presume he's still making records. So we're not in a position as we were, let's say, with Shakespeare, where we don't know enough. We're in a position where we know too much, but there isn't any meaning. And it seems to me that it is meaning that is of significance and of use to us, rather than an undifferentiated deluge of material. If nothing is ever lost, how do we struggle to find meaning in all this trivia?
Is that what we're doing here? Just accumulating trivia, turning our culture into Steptoe's yard? This is the live me, by the way, not the pre-recorded archive me. If you've just tuned in, do stay, because this programme is a one-off. It's not going on the iPlayer, it won't be repeated, it's an archive on four without any archive. It doesn't even have any off-the-shelf music. Those strange and beautiful string sounds were recorded specially for us by the improvising harpist Rodri Davis, and he'll never play any of them ever again. So let's just enjoy the moment as best we can, eh? I know you may not be listening in perfect circumstances. Maybe you're in a car going under a motorway bridge. Maybe nobody else in the room likes this programme and they're looking at you with their special sour lemon faces. That's just life, isn't it? And life is slipping away, minute by minute. It would be foolish to pretend otherwise. Which means I need to take us back to that storage place in Horsham.
Maybe the people in the office can help me find it. Hi there, yeah, I just wanted a bit of advice on how to find my box. I've got a unit number, but...
Right, okay.
So in the Sony archives, they're 78s and their original recordings, which is sort of like climate controlled and everything. All the people working there were getting mysteriously sick. And they discovered that all these viruses that were contained in the kind of cardboard and everything, that were being perfectly controlled and maintained by the humidity control, was infecting them all.
Archive Fever, this programme is called. We stole it from a French critical theorist with really cool hair. We'll get to him in a moment. First, let's do the diagnostic work. Today, the term archive is applied to collections of state papers and to the ghosts of the web pages you visited this week. There are seed archives and cartoon archives. The Victoria and Albert Museum has a shoe archive containing over 2,000 pairs. There's a shop in Deptford in southeast London called the Semiconductor Archives. I always look at it through the bus window. It sells obscure electrical components, or sold. It seems to have closed down, though it's hard to tell from the outside. It may now be an archive of itself.
I hope that doesn't belong to me.
And as I sit on the bus, my own archive attends me. It's there on my phone, all those call records, emails, texts, photographs, web links, with thousands and thousands more in the data cloud that I can siphon down with ease when the signal's good or if we pass in the range of the Wi-Fi from Pret-a-Manger. The archive is in the air. It's all around us. I don't want to sound like one of those tinfoil hat people, but is that really a good thing? Might it not be better to look out of the window than down at a little screen? If you're always staring back into the past, then doesn't that stop you paying attention to the, sorry, I've lost my thread.
Let me just read you this.
You're leaping through your own person.
I am indeed. This is a Chinese encyclopedia. Animals are divided into A, belonging to the emperor, B, embalmed, C, tame, D, sucking pigs, E, sirens, F, fabulous, and then we get to my favourites at the end, M, having just broken the water pitcher, and N, that look like a long, from a long way off like flies. That's the classification system of this Chinese encyclopedia. And Foucault's saying, and indeed Derrida says the same thing, that the assumptions behind classification tell you an awful lot about the archive, and they're of their moment.
So here are the crates, and we're on a kind of mezzanine floor. Red and yellow doors, all padlocked. They're big, they're bigger than I remember. 512...
Now, a little while back, Christopher Frayling said the D word, Derrida, Jacques Derrida. He's the guy with the big hair and the big ideas, a critical theorist with a dizzyingly complicated prose style. In 1995, just less than a decade before his death, he wrote a book called Archive Fever, a criticism of the institution of the archive and the impulses that drive it. The top Cambridge thinker, Andy Martin, has written about everything from surfing to the thrillers of Lee Child. He was a student of Derrida. That's Andy, not Lee, as far as I know. Did Derrida use email?
Yes, he did use email at some point. It's the short answer to that, actually. I tried to get Derrida on the radio once upon a time, actually. And he never liked to say yes or no, because that was too binary. So he said,
I can imagine him hesitating slightly when putting something after the colon with the word subject before it.
Yeah,
as well.
Right. And I think he originally said something like, you know, absolument, to, you know, oh, yeah, oh that's a yes then, is it? And then I think I finally tracked him down and said, oh, yeah, so you know how you said absolument. So is that yes or no? And again, he refused to say yes or no. And he said something like, I confess my sins.
So are you rolling your eyes? Why are you rolling your eyes when I mentioned Derrida, Caroline?
Well, Jacques Derrida wrote an interesting article called Archive Fever. One could say you can track back to that article this concept that we're all archivists now, we're all curators now.
Caroline's a bit sceptical about that. She's a professional archivist, a professional curator. Years of training have told her what's worth keeping and what's fit for the bin. If we are all archivists, as Derrida suggests, then that doesn't mean we're any good at it. We might just have got worse at throwing things away. But what did Derrida actually write? Well, he was suspicious of the archive because he saw it as a kind of tyrannical institution. Its tyrants exerted their power not over space, but time. If it's your job to decide what's worth preserving about the present, then you can influence the future because your decisions shape the future's sense of what the past was like. That's why we have Black History Month, to attempt to recover black experience from the indifference of past decision-makers, past archival gatekeepers. So Derrida saw the archivist as a little despot, but he also did a lot of left-bank-style shrugging about historians. Historians, he thought, always want to look back and search for the roots of things. They always want to start at the beginning, which his book Archive Fever resolutely refuses to do. Derrida thought the search for the beginning was another illness that required a cure. Social historian Carolyn Steedman.
The sickness is this compulsion of historians to find where things started, a compulsive search for the origin of things, for things that aren't there to be found because the past isn't there, is a kind of sick compulsion.
A sick compulsion. I told you I was ill.
I feel there's a touch of Scandi noir about this, or like in some sinister IKEA.
I did this morning see if the Oxford English Dictionary has updated its entry for archive, but its last etymological entry is still 1865. And there's a note to say that this entry has not been updated. You know, it's just waiting for the boys and girls to get round to that bit of continuous labour. I think several things happened in the 1990s that made this word enter everyday vocabulary. The work of Derrida had been around for about 10 years and was in translation. And local record officers started to call what they held not documents or papers or records, but archives. So if you went to Warwickshire County Record Office in the 1980s or early 1990s, you never talked about going to the archives. You say, I'm going to the record office, I'm going to get to my documents, all right. And you would say to students, what you really need to do is get into the records. 10 years later, you were saying what you really need to do is get into the archive.
What's your beef with Derrida, though? Do you think he's undermined the idea of the archive in some ways?
I just think he's incomprehensible.
Although it's Derrida being, you know, obscurely academic, and actually occasionally one has to say turgid, he really hits the nail on the head at a certain point, because he says there's also a part of us that wants to destroy the archive.
Oh, what's that?
This is a fire drill. Will you please evacuate the building?
Please leave the building immediately by the nearest exit. Do not use the lifts. Please leave the building.
Right, we better get out. By the nearest exit.
There's no way that any archive could cope with the enormous range of material that's being produced today, much of which, let's face it, is ephemera and not worth keeping for future generations.
Some ephemera is worth keeping, though, isn't
some
it?
Ephemera,
I mean, ephemera, some of the greatest archives in the world are archives of ephemera.
Some ephemera is definitely worth keeping, but even that has been selected deliberately as samples of ephemera.
So,
otherwise, we would all be drowning in information.
So is Derrida presenting a dream or a nightmare, then?
I think he thinks he's presenting a dream.
But you know
I think it's actually
entails.
A nightmare.
Alice in Wonderland, you know, there's a big argument with Alice and Humpty Dumpty, and Humpty Dumpty says, that word means there's a fine knockdown argument for you. And Alice says, that word doesn't mean that. You can't just say words mean what you want them to say. And Humpty Dumpty says, the question is, who is to be master? And that's exactly the same with archives. Someone has decided what to keep, what to throw away, and in that decision is an ideology, an assumption, a story, which may well be out of date.
724, 723, 722, and here, the double yellow door marked 721. Now, there's a padlock on the front of this. Here's the keys. Let's go.
That's a cliffhanger, isn't it? And it's the end of our third pre-recorded element. Soon it'll be delivered to me here in the studio. And on the table here is the hammer with which I'm going to destroy it. And I just want you to know that I'm not feeling great about this. Me and my producer, Martin, worked hard on this programme and it's doomed. We're not enjoying ourselves here, are we? Yeah, he's shaking his head through the glass. But maybe it'll be good for us not to get what we want for a change.
There's something deadly, isn't there, about the box set binge, the one more episode on demand. It's made Augustus Gloops of us all, watching telly on our phones, on the train and the bus, watching when our kids are trying to talk to us, watching in the pub, the back catalogue of recorded human culture in a library that never closes.
It became a kind of game to me to count how many people were looking at a bright screen while cycling with headphones on. There is a speed limit of 20 miles an hour in this area. I tend to go at about 12 because I know that nobody can hear my car anymore. Even a year and a half, 2 years ago, it was like, how many people can you see? It's virtually everyone now. And I found that really depressing. Then I had a sort of turnaround thought, which is that if I'm honest, everyone looks happy. They're laughing, they're talking, they're communicating.
They don't have that expression of quiet optimism with which Winston Smith tells himself he should adopt whenever he faces the telescreen. Mm-hmm.
I know someone's making a lot of money from all of these things, but at the same time, it seems to me that people do like to communicate with each other. And whether you call it virtual communication or real communication, I think that line has gone.
I wonder whether some of that happiness isn't produced by the sense of what we do when we're on our phones, is being logged and archived in some ways. The idea of the timeline is very powerful, isn't it? That we're building up strata of these little interactions and little experiences. So at the end of the day, we've got some proof that we do exist.
Absolutely.
I'm going to open up some of these.
I love how these things have now become police tools. You know, it's the first thing you check. You have to be really smart if you're going to outwit the digital world as well.
It's like somebody just left the room and said, oh, I'll be back in 10 minutes, and then stayed away for 10 years.
Oh, wow!
Oh, now... what we've got here is a big portfolio. Miscellaneous, this says, rather worryingly.
Oh! Good
grief!
Yeah, the envelope's full of slightly musty papers.
Oh, they're a bit damp. What I really want to find is my precious first issue of Doctor Who Weekly, signed by Tom Baker. If that has gone rumply, you will hear me cry on the radio.
So if you go to a concert or a gig these days, there'll generally be people in the audience who have their phones out, who are documenting the experience. And some artists are not very keen on that. There's a clip of Adele having a word with one of her fans on this subject. If I could just find this clip on my phone. Okay. Here it is.
God, it stopped raining. Yeah, I want to tell that lady as well. Can you stop filming me with a video camera? Because I'm really here in real life. You can enjoy it in real life rather than...
Is the desire to document, to utter all the time in the digital age, to record the concert on the phone while you're at the concert. Is there something neurotic about that?
It can distract from the moment if you're just viewing the world through your viewfinder. And I used to accuse my father of that because Dad was definitely the type of person who would just look at the world through his camera, his sort of SLR camera. And now everybody's doing it because everybody has the opportunity to do that.
I'm taking the picture because I want to remember which picture I particularly liked, but I'm aware that I'm not enjoying the moment because of taking this picture.
There is a delight in showing and showcasing. We've wanted to capture forever. You know, people who went out and did clippings of rare plants and took samples of animals and brought them back in the Victorian era. Absolutely, they were doing exactly the same thing. It's a bit of, you know, you're showing off to your mates. You've been to this gig. You went to Disneyland. You did all this stuff that was, you were there at that moment in time.
There does seem to be, I think, a sort of puritanism about people who complain about those who are sticking their phones up in the air at concerts. Because, I mean, you know, you could equally say, well, shut your eyes and listen to the music, couldn't you? Don't be distracted by the visual world. Hear the music. Shut your eyes.
I was a film archivist in the early 1970s for the Imperial War Museum, used to work in the lead-lined vaults of the government film archive, and the reason they're lead-lined is that up until the end of the Second World War, official film was shot on nitrate stock, which is combustible, and it decays, and it's very, very dangerous. And I do remember one occasion where I was cataloguing some Second World War footage, and here was a very juicy-looking can that said on the outside, U-boat footage. I thought, well, this is great. You know, dive, dive, dive. This is going to be something. And I opened it, and it was brown jelly with a bubble in the middle, and it went bloop, and I chucked it into this vat of acid, because it actually burns underwater, nitrate film, and nobody will ever see that can of film of U-boat footage again.
What did you feel when Christopher was telling that story? I've got to confess, I found it terribly exciting, dramatic, moving. The idea of something gone like that. Maybe that's more powerful than whatever was on the film. It feels like a slightly dangerous pleasure, one that seems on the side of people who don't care about history, about libraries, about culture, you know, morally doubtful people. But still, the idea of making something and then losing it, that's something I'm willing to test with this programme. The hammer, ladies and gentlemen, is on the table in the studio. Christopher made his point, film is fragile. Maybe all our digital remains are also doomed to decay. Perhaps analogue culture will turn out to be the robust source from which future generations will get their sense of the past. If so, the canon may be staffed by figures such as the American composer William Basinski, who's been making music with obsolete analogue technology since the late 1970s, particularly with tape loops.
You take a piece of analogue tape and cut a little strip out and then splice it together so you have a loop. And that way you can record one little phrase and it repeats over and over and over again, over and over and over and over again, over and over and over again, over and over and over and over again, over and over and over and over and over and over and over. I did a lot of this kind of work in the early 80s in New York, recording sounds out of the airwaves, off the radio. So I would record things on the high speed and then slow them down and see what they did. And sometimes they would come out just amazing. You'd have this loop that just, you couldn't hear the beginning or the end. It just created a whole world. Some of these were so good, I knew I didn't have to do anything to them. And I didn't know if I could really call them my work, because there was no real context at that time for sampling or any of that sort of thing that everybody does now.
Shall we have a look inside some of the boxes? Oh, wow. Here is a Czechoslovakian magazine about combine harvesters. Excuse me, it's rather dusty. Look, CD racks. Towers to put CDs in. Do you remember CDs? VHSs. You know, this is a snapshot of a technological life that no longer really exists. Analog portable television, VHSs, CD towers. They're no use to anybody these days. You know, we can now look back to the teens and the 20s and look at the lists of all the films that were made and all the films that were missing. Then we could feel that pang of pain that this film was taken and was dropped into a vat of hydrogen peroxide and recycled along with the broken spectacles mm-hmm. and old false teeth and turned into waterproof paint. Mm-hmm. That process is gone. Maybe what we will be doing now is looking at this plenitude of films that there is no time to take a look at. Mm. And we might even feel nostalgic about the lack of those blank spaces.
Mm-hmm. A large amount of time is spent just copying things now to try and be one step ahead of the position you don't want to be in, where you have a whole bunch of tapes and there is no equipment to play those tapes on or copy them on anymore.
Around the time when CD burners came out, I went back into the back, found my old stuff and started listening to it again and started archiving it to digital. And in late July, August of 2001, I came across this cache of loops. So pulled up this loop, put it on the Nagra. Oh, this loop was just so haunting. So I started recording, and after a few minutes, I started realizing something was changing. What an analog tape is pretty much rust glued to plastic. And the thing that loses its integrity first is the glue. Then the iron oxide particles, which hold the sound, start turning back to dust and falling into the tape path. Engineers call it dropout. So what happens is little bits of sound are falling off the tape, so you're getting little bits of silence. These melodies died right before my ears, but in the most beautiful way.
I wonder, actually, whether the archive is as strong and as safe an idea as most people assume. We may feel like we're building all of this stuff up and that we're living these lives where nothing goes undocumented, nothing goes unnoticed, but it may take some quite small electromagnetic event to completely erase our digital memories, the digital memory of the culture.
Mm. This is our fear, fundamental fear, isn't it? That we are ourselves going to be erased. Presumably the origin of the archive is in the opposite of the death drive. It's in the life drive, a desire for immortality. So we're trying to preserve all these things which you fear will be lost.
I realized I had recorded the life and death of these melodies. And then the next thing you knew, I was going to go for a job interview at the World Trade Center on September 11th. 2001. Luckily, the interview was for 11 o'clock in the morning, but of course, by then the buildings were gone. And we saw it all happen from the roof, and we were stunned and shocked and just completely like, this can't happen. I mean, how could that happen?
What would the world be like if we lost our archives? What would that do to us?
I think it would set us adrift in time and space without any sense of who we were. It would be a nightmare.
Now, 9/11 was really interesting because everyone filmed it on their phone. And the amount of footage of that event, there's well-taken stuff on proper cameras, there's the news footage that we've seen. There are thousands of people who held up their phone down the street, further away, over a car, children looking up and all the rest of it. As a collage, is probably the most visually covered event in history because it was such an extreme thing to happen. What do you do with that? Do you collect it all and say, well, this is all part of the kaleidoscope of history and isn't that interesting? Or do you say, actually, there's one or two views that tell you what was going on and that's all we need?
And then later that evening, my friend had her camera on the roof and I had her help me frame it up, and I just shot the last hour of daylight. One static shot looking at where the Twin Towers once were and where this clouds of this smoke was just blowing to the east. And then the next day I mixed it up with Disintegration Loop 1.1, and then it was like, oh God. So I had this video elegy of the last hour of daylight on that day. Anyway, that's kind of the story of the disintegration loops.
The archive is against nature. Everything in the archive, nature wants that back. She's licking her lips at the thought of all that cellulose and celluloid. We don't yet know what kind of appetite she has for digital material. She might one day devour it all in some great burst of electrons. But at the moment, digital data seems harder to break down than paper and film. So will this hammer here really do the job? Isn't this programme already moving promiscuously through the wires and servers, even as we speak? Isn't it on its way to Alpha Centauri? I need to think about this. So let's have the final pre-recorded element. We're going to do our best to destroy the programme that we are helping to make now. Mm-hmm. You and I are having a conversation in a studio at the BBC. That will be then taken by Martin, the producer, and woven into something beautiful. Something that will evoke all sorts of thoughts and feelings in the minds of the listener, we hope. It'll only be broadcast once. It won't go onto the iPlayer. And then we will do our best to, if we can, in this digital world, remove it.
Destroy.
From the world.
Erase. Delete. It's a wonderful impulse. I wonder if it's even possible.
Is there any advice, do you think, you can give us? How could we obliterate
aliens are going to pick it up and rebroadcast it back at the Earth at some stage, actually, and you'll never get away.
If it was open reel tape, I can imagine wiping it. You get a nice hissing noise as it gets wiped as you go along, sort of self-wiping programme.
But we both know the reality is that even on my phone, I can record it. The potential for it to be cloned a million times, we've moved beyond that. We cannot throw anything away.
You can't kill it that easily. It's out there. It's in the ether.
I completely echo your aspiration. Those things can haunt you and control you to some extent. I think Beckett had this crap's last tape, actually, that he keeps going back to these old recordings of his and is living through those recordings. I think it would be very, very liberating to delete me, to annihilate me and my thoughts and my words right now, because the great advantage of that is that you would then be able to embrace the transient. Perhaps if one could destroy the archive, maybe, I suppose, that is the ultimate dream, that you could, you know, recover that lost intensity and spontaneity.
We may be doomed to failure, as you say.
Heroic failure.
Or just masochism. Really.
Vandalism.
Some other,
yeah,
vandalism.
Yeah, there's a hooligan element to this whole thing, actually.
Yeah.
You're putting
the
boot in, aren't you?
Is it possible now to make a programme that can be for one night only? I want some advice from you, really, about how to destroy the programme that you and I are contributing to now.
Oh, man. See, I don't think like that. I've always been somebody who's documented, whether that's through photographs or whether that's through writing or whether it's through making silly recordings of my voice from the age of 4. I adore archives. I love being able to look back and reassemble. And so how to create a program that isn't captured?
Andy, we've been talking for about an hour now in this studio at the BBC. The entire running time of our program is just under an hour. The program that is heading towards destruction. The clock is ticking here. Is there anything that you would like to say to the listeners before your part in this is deleted? Something that they will have to retain in their memories because this program is going nowhere.
You know, I thought while you were saying that, what you actually meant was you're going to end up on the cutting room floor anyway, Matt. So.
You mean you might not get this far?
But the public might be gagging to hear the bits of this interview that you've thrown away. And they may regret forever the aperçus that have gone into the bin, and that would be a terrible thing.
I think, okay, so we're all going to end up on the cutting room floor. We've got to live with that. We've got to embrace that, I think.
Alex, we're trying to work out the best way to destroy this programme, to destroy the flashcards upon which it's been recorded. What do I do? Do I boil them? Burn them? What can I do?
Just take a hammer to them. Just smash them with a hammer. Or you can pick them up. They're small. They're fiddly. Just split them.
So just snap them.
Yeah, snap them.
Snap them like an After Eight.
That's right.
Or a biscuit.
Snap, archive. Snap to you.
Right, let's get out of the past and walk out into the present.
How do we get rid of stuff? And how do we ever say when enough would be enough?
Norman Stanley Fletcher.
When do we stop staring into the entrails of the past and clear a space in order to live in the present and in the future?
Locked. One day I shall come back. Right, now I need to clean the dirt of the past off my hands, I think.
I love the archive. I probably love it too much. I love the past and its brick and bakelite and parchment remains. The present is often disappointing. The past never disappoints. But I know that this is a neurotic position, and if the compulsion to archive, to preserve, to let nothing go unrecorded is a kind of cultural illness, then here's the jab. One hammer, five little memory cards, which will soon forget everything they know. But we won't. We were here, weren't we, you and me? And perhaps we're both of an age to know that there was a time when you had to remember things because the world was mainly undocumented. Not like now. If we all vanish tomorrow, leaving our digital remains behind, then alien archaeologists could probably make quite a good fist of recreating our world, if they have fists, that is. With Google Maps and all our selfies and Instagram pictures, I reckon they'd stand a good chance of being able to construct a playable environment. The Earthlings. Oh yes, they'll say, they were the ones who always had something nice for dinner and loved their jobs, hashtag so blessed, and read Hanif Qureshi's diary. But those aliens, they'll never, never hear this programme. This has been just for us. Just for now. First though...
Last one.
Thank you, Martin. First though, I'm going to tear up my script. There they go. All the words. And now the concluding act of violence. I'm going to nail these memory cards to a piece of wood. And when I've done that, I'll tweet the evidence. So, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Gone.
Archive Fever was presented by Matthew Sweet, and the producer was Martin Williams. And if you want to listen again to this programme, well, I'm afraid you can't. Something that has been laid down for posterity many times is the music of Bach. And on the Radio 4 website now, you can listen again to the sumptuous drama Bach, The Great Passion, with music and choral rehearsal which were recorded in Edinburgh's Grey Friars Kirk.
Wow. Wow.
Wow.
That was pretty good.
That was pretty good. You know, I mean, it's the kind of slickly produced radio that I remember our old station manager, Brett, used to urge us to make.
It's true. Yeah, we don't have sound effects or music infills.
We're not those kind of people.
No, we're not.
But it's nice that other people do. I don't hold it against people.
No, it's fine if you want to make radio sound like a minor motion picture. But that's not really our thing here. We come from improvised music.
That's right. This is free jazz.
It's true. Speaking of jazz, I especially like the bit, which seemed too good to be true, of the guy keeping the archive of his jazz records and not the jazz records themselves.
Yeah.
Like, what do you do with those?
The Matrix numbers and everything like that? I mean, like,
like, you know, like, oh, Bill Evans played on these 178 albums or whatever.
Well, but it also came down to, like, pressings and Matrix numbers and stuff like that. Like, an invaluable resource, pre-Discogs.
And I guess certainly there are people that collect records not for the pleasure of listening to them.
In fact, I would argue, at a certain point, if you own more than 100 records,
it's true,
you have gone beyond the mere pleasure principle. Because, like, at any given point in time, you don't listen to...
No, you figure the average record's 30-something minutes. I mean, you start to get up into a sheer amount of duration that you couldn't enjoy at some point.
Yeah,
it's like, well, if you own 46 years worth of recorded audio,
yeah,
like, when you, which, you know, I guess we should just go ahead and let the
listeners to this show might have heard rather theatrically, if I want to make a call back to the intro, that the host, Matthew Sweet, I believe, was in the studio with a hammer, making some big threats, and in the end, he nails some SD cards to a board.
Yeah. And you can catch Matthew this summer at Newcastle on Tyne performing in The Tempest by none other than William Shakespeare.
Shakespeare.
Yeah. Which is what all British people do in their
which is what everyone
time.
Does in the summers. Yeah, everyone, there's enough people to do all the Shakespeare and watch all the Shakespeare, because when you're not doing it, you're watching it.
It's true.
And
at some point, our culture will have produced recorded so much Shakespeare that no single human could watch all the recorded Shakespeare.
I think we're already there.
Oh, no. That's what the Anthropocene means?
Yeah, is when you pass the amount of Shakespeare.
Amount of watchable Shakespeare in one human life.
Just on a side note, it's cool that, like, not everyone has, like, a Shakespeare. Like, the Spanish version is, like, Cervantes, who's a novelist.
Okay. So, what's the American version?
I don't know. John Ford movies or something? Like,
sure.
You know,
Yeah.
Well, there is a dude on a bicycle coming down the highway off ramp that I can see right now.
Shirtless.
Holy shit. That is king shit. Anyway. Yeah.
Speaking of Shakespeare.
Speaking of things like that probably aren't going to end well. like a tragedy by Shakespeare.
Speaking of unarchivable events.
you just have to take our word for it. But listeners may wonder how, if the BBC destroyed their copy of this, and all the materials on the memory cards that went out into making the radio you just heard was destroyed, was nailed to a board. How is it? And if some of the music that you heard accompanying it was delivered live in studio while it was being produced, how is it that we came to re-air this?
That's a great question, Steve.
Nicholas?
Well, we have a small handful of dedicated listeners. And at some point, we reached out to these various listeners. Our marketing team here at K-Chung forced us to, trying to understand how the listenership numbers get where they are. And, of course, Mark So is one of them. Not surprising. He's been on the show several times. He's a late-night creature. He likes these kinds of musical projects, if you can call this that. Mm. So that's not surprising. But another listener of ours, turns out, came across our show because he records every live stream of radio that's going on in the universe or in the entire globe. That he's aware of. So speaking of someone who has too much recorded media to actually intake it all, this person recorded this and sent it to us, not anonymously, but under the name, the hallowed name, of Solomon Bothwell.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's not surprising that he's been doing this all these years.
No,
but
no. What do you think he's doing in there, folks? Why would you start a radio station if not to get more streams for your archive?
Yeah, you think that tower on the top of K-Chung is an antenna? Antennas are receivers, too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where he gets it all from.
Yeah. He can record any stream within 200 feet of the station.
Within 200 feet.
Of which the talking show definitely falls in this category.
Think ye upon that, ye mighty and despair. That's where we got it from.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be fun
yeah.
to sneak it back into the BBC iPlayer.
Steve, with his experts when it comes to small computations.
Yeah, I took a little look at the way that the SQL database for the media player is structured.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a little look at how the CDN, the content delivery network, was structured. And I was able to put it back in.
Reverse shoplift it.
Yeah. So it's back in there. And it sounds a little weird because it's been through a couple generations of copying. But,
yeah.
You know, it's back in there now. So you can just go check it out.
Yep.
What did you think of the actual... I thought it was like a pretty fun discussion of, you know, the problems of keeping stuff and like a nice little gloss on Derrida as well. I thought it was pretty good.
It made me like Derrida even more. I wouldn't say I'm like a big fan, but I'm, you know, I think I'm getting to the age where I have enough time where I'm like, I could try and read that guy.
Wow.
Like, why not?
Where are you getting all this time from?
I don't know. I live in the suburbs.
Yeah.
But anywho, I've been warming up to him in his impossible style.
The big
style.
Problem is the translation, really. I think he's quite charming in French. And I think he's like everything I've seen of him in person.
Yeah.
He was like,
real fun.
Seems fun and charming. Yeah. Seems like a cool guy.
Yeah. But I'm also like, I loved the bit how he never said yes or no. That was, yeah. I'm going to try and do that.
Same. it's like,
I feel like you do that, Steve. You've already mastered that.
I'd like to think I'm pretty good at things like that.
Yeah.
But I think that I could do better. I think that like making it a firm commitment.
Yeah.
Like, I think that obviously, like, you know, when I was a teen, and a combination of my own interests and fate led me to like a degree in semiotics,
mm-hmm.
Which was the first one I got. You know, it's obvious why someone like Derrida would be one of the sort of appealing figures that would lead a young person to enter that world, right? Like you mm-hmm. were like, oh, this seems fun.
Yeah.
These figures seem charming. Why don't I do this? You know, like it does. But obviously, there's like an aspect of my own existence that like does hate to decide one way or the other, wants to keep everything open. So there's that. But I think like taking it a step farther and literally refusing to make yes or no equivocations.
Yeah.
Is I think that's a good step. I think it would actually be like psychologically healing.
Yeah. To commit to that.
Because you'd be making an active sort of position and doing it with intention as opposed to merely like dwelling in one's own anxieties about making the right choice.
Well, yeah. And also within his own intellectual climate, it's almost a refusal to be useful in a way. Because so much of the Marxist theory before that was like, we're solving the problems of the working class from our academic posts or whatever.
Well, I think that Derrida had given up on being useful along, like openly.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
yeah.
Hostile
it, it
to
it was
utility.
A position.
Yeah,
it was
yeah, a position. Yeah, openly.
But also amazing how warmly disliked he is. Because like, if you're an archivist, you don't have a ton of philosophers who've like committed any text or thinking to your pursuits. He's like one of the big ones. And almost everyone that interviewed who's an active participant in this field is like, yeah, I don't like it. I don't like it one bit. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah. You know, well, an unfortunate bugbear of mine is the presence of William Basinski.
Ooh.
I don't know. I don't like the music. And I feel like musically is the kind of thing that like Wolfgang Voigt's Gas makes a better feeling version of the same kind of thing. And the point about like poorly stored tape deteriorates, you know, do you want to listen to the tape destroy itself? Doesn't fill me with like, I
would hear it as the tape itself deteriorates, but like getting sent a CD of that. No, thanks.
Yeah, right. Like
an installation where you're like, all right, we're gonna turn the thing on. In 4 hours, it'll be over forever.
Yeah, you will have witnessed something, and there's a precious erratic.
Yeah.
Precisely. You know,
like Ikebana or something.
And then, yeah, exactly. And then, absolutely. And then that subsequently this like eternally preserved digital version of this deteriorating tape is then somehow woven into the 9/11 narrative. this like structural...
The cover of the album is the 9/11 picture?
Yeah, media critique. You know, like, because like I am all for a sort of media-specific action within... You know, long-time listeners know I'm a great fan of structural filmmaking, for example, right? Yeah. And that's the kind of shit we talk about when you talk about running the film through the projector and what goes... Yeah, but bing, bang, boom, you made a Paul Sheretz film. Like... Yeah. I think that that is like an amazing aspect of recordable media is that it does deteriorate through use and things like that. And you can witness it. And that can be part of a body of work. Sure, sure. Absolutely. It can be part of an installation or a performance. But to take that sort of overt formal conceit and immediately graft it onto sort of like... generational... A historic event of generational... sort of traumatic import feels so... I mean, I guess we can't argue with Baczynski's reporting on the subject that, like, these things happened at the same time. But, like, you know, fuck. I mean, like, it's just, like, another horrible thing that happened as a result of 9/11. It's like there's... Osama bin Laden is in his cave, you know, being like, we did it, boys. We did it. Yeah. We took down the Twin Towers. And... William Baczynski,
a cutting problem.
Has produced this a cutting problem, and William Baczynski has produced this extremely bland
another cutting problem,
ambient
actually.
Music. Yeah, well, it's not a cutting problem. It's more of like a cohesion problem. It's more about like the glue failing.
What was on the tapes to begin with?
Recordings he had made long before
of himself,
of
like,
his own compositions. Yeah.
Okay.
And then just making
so
them into loops.
But if he framed it as like my original compositions were so bad that they only were worth listening to
as they're destroyed,
as they're falling apart 20 years later, that'd be more charming, I think.
Yeah, and
not that like somehow this is the capstone on the end of the American Empire or something.
Yeah,
like that.
And 9/11. You know, yeah. Please, dude. I don't know. I don't know. And it's not like I'm not above making a 9/11 joke or something like that, but there's something about it that just rubs me the wrong way. Like, it's not like I feel like the people who lost loved ones are being disrespected by Baczynski making his ambient music career out of 9/11.
What's your, I mean, not to get too much into musical talk, but what's your big glitch with Baczynski?
Kind of that it's like strapped to a narrative and that like it's not particularly compelling in the first place, but then it has to be important. Like, it's reception. My glitch is the sort
okay,
of like
that's what I figured. Yeah.
The reception and the marketing. Because, like, I, you know,
it is seen as hallowed for some reason.
If it just existed, it would be fine.
Yeah, like music for airports. It's like Brian Eno's just like, I wanted to make ambient music.
Oh, I was in a car accident and I was recovering in bed.
Yeah, I wanted to chill out.
But then the I guess a secondary quibble, now, since it became such an important aspect of that body, that genre of music, is that like you say, it's like the main conceit of the tape deteriorating is like destroyed by digitizing the entire thing.
Yeah, that seems like a cheap trick.
I think that's I think that's true.
Yeah.
I think that's the other thing too, the sort of like the, if we just want to take it without its sort of like ancillary narrative thing about 9/11 and just consider it as a thing, it's like it is, there's this like, you know, this like hallowed special moment being sort of represented by the tape deteriorating and you catching the last moments of this thing and you're like, well, guess what, like
it's also a little bit like you know, every undergrad computer music person discovers at some point that when you slow anything down it sounds sublime.
Yeah,
and it kind of just sounds. It's like he slowed that dollar bin humpback whales record down.
Yeah,
and you're like, yeah, of course that's gonna sound awesome.
Yeah,
like on drugs especially.
Yeah,
but yeah, just strap it together. It's kind of like, you know, the artist Rosa Barba.
Rosa Barba.
I think she's German filmmaker. But
okay, no.
One of those contemporary artists that insists on always having like the 16 millimeter looper in the okay. gallery, which yeah. I always found obnoxious when I first got into contemporary art, and now it's like a really impressive move. Just like because it's so hard to do and such a pain.
Loading them is so stressful.
Yeah, and those for some reason she was always complaining when I met her about those loopers. They cost a fortune.
They're very expensive.
There's only like one guy who makes them or something. Yeah. Now I'm just like, yeah, Basinski had done that, props. Just like load up the tapes, burn them up once a year in a gallery or something, and then
make it.
You're
really
not going
to
run out of tapes. Make more tapes. It'd be fine. It just,
yeah.
It just require more work.
Yeah, and I think, well.
Instead of just collecting your editions Amigo checks or whatever.
I don't even.
Those fat royalties.
I don't even think Edicio Amigo touches Basinski. I think.
Yeah, they're too classy for that.
Peter Rieberg feels the same way we do.
Yeah, he's on Capitol.
I think he might be on Nonesuch.
Okay, perfect.
It's the same thing, basically, right? It's like EMI or.
Yeah, they got bought out, anyhow.
But.
Whatever. He's not on Blue Note. We know that. On that note, it's getting kind of late, Steve.
This tape here, the Steve tape, might just disintegrate any time.
You know, we're gonna record all this onto analog tape and then wait for some major attack on U.S. soil, and we're gonna slow those tapes down that day, and we're just gonna eclipse Basinski's reign.
It's gonna be
on
incredible,
the
folks.
American attack, slowed down tape market.
Yeah. It's like the only piece of art that's made me like 9/11 less, you know, or more.
You're a huge fan.
I mean, okay. I think it's pretty impressive. What did Zizek say? It's like the greatest work of art of the 20th century, 21st century.
He is quite the provocateur.
You know, it's like it's outrageous work.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah.
Not happy it happened, but it is crazy that it happened.
Yeah. It was a hit.
Yeah, it's a cutting problem.
All right. Good morning, Chinatown.
Good night.